in Genesis chapter 8. We finished a whole chapter last week.
Oh, there's a lot. That's funny, right? That's so funny. That's just hysterical. He walked down the aisle and he saw me. He turned around. He walked funny.
I'm not sure I was at the right place.
Am I in your seat?
No.
Are you sure?
Well, you're kind of.
Well, would you like me to be? Because I know how y'all are about your church.
I want you to be exactly where you
are. I know how y'all are about your church people.
Just get over. Own it.
And then you want me close. I'm not sure I like that.
I was going to ask what was going on over there.
Genesis chapter 8.
Look closer.
Genesis chapter 8.
Oh, thank you. A little closer.
Genesis chapter 8.
Absolutely not.
So who remembers what happened last week?
It flooded.
In our story. It rained.
There was a lot of rain.
There was a lot
of rain.
More than here.
There was a whole lot of rain last week.
My gosh,
yeah.
Rain.
40 days and 40 nights. We talked about the animals. We talked about the fact that the waters prevailed on the land for 150 days.
377 days.
Theories.
377, a couple of theories depending on how you add up those days. 377 on the ark, 370 in the water. Good. So we ended at the end of chapter 7. With the waters prevailing on the earth for 150 days. And we finished again the whole entire chapter last week. And we did get to the rain. That was our goal. And it did finally rain. Now we're in chapter 8. We're going to pick up chapter 8 and see how far we can get in chapter 8. I do have to leave a little earlier today than normal. So just wanted to give you guys a heads up on that. So I'm going to pick up right away. Just let's pick up in chapter 8. We know what's going on. Noah's on the ark with a bunch of animals and his family. And it's been raining for 150 days. Pick up in chapter 8, verse 1. I read out of the ESV. It says, "But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind blow over the earth, and the waters subsided." One verse is what I'm going to start with. And so the very first thing that we start with is, "But God remembered Noah." It's interesting that that's the terminology that's used. And I think most of the translations say some version of the fact that God remembered Noah. And, you know, when you say that somebody remembered someone, there's an implication that that person was forgotten. Right?
That's probably not the case here.
Probably not the case here. It doesn't necessarily imply that God forgot Noah, but it's an indication that God had faithfulness in his promise to Noah. Remember, God had locked him in and had spoken to him before the flood. And one of the things that I said before, and you guys may or may not remember, is there's no indication that while he's been on the ark for 150 plus days, that there's been any communication from God, right? He didn't have his cell phone, he didn't have a satellite dish, and God was talking to him the whole time. All right, it's time to feed the animals, you know, it's time to do whatever, right? There's probably a period of silence there. And from Noah's perspective, it may have felt like he had been forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I'm sure Noah likes that word. I'm sure he felt forgotten for 150 days or whatever. He's in a boat, all the animals.
And
the entire world has been flooded.
With his wife and his kids.
This has never happened before. Noah probably doesn't know exactly what's going to happen next, right? He just knows he's on the boat. He just knows he's being faithful to what God had asked him to do. And up until this point, God has shown him, be faithful, get on the ark, build the ark, get the animals, be on the ark, be faithful in that. Noah doesn't have a vision beyond that at this point,
right?
There's not, other than he knows that he and his family are being saved, I would assume that he would assume that eventually, like, he wasn't going to have to live on the ark for the rest of his life, right? But here it is.
Noah was definitely having an issue. He was type A.
What's that?
Noah would definitely have an issue. He was a type A person.
Yeah. What's going to happen next? What's the plan?
What's the end result? I have to know.
Yeah,
he wasn't type A. He was faithful.
Imagine, right, so you
know what I'm saying? Yeah.
You look out the window. You kind of
are we there
see
yet?
Progress. You can see the landscape change. He looks out.
Nothing.
Doesn't this foreshadow other
same stars?
You know, stories later in the Bible of
sail,
of isolation, and you know,
there's
like,
no wind.
40 years in the desert in Genesis.
Yeah, last week we talked about the 40 years.
And,
the number 40 is Yeah, we mentioned that last week. The number 40 is throughout the Bible. And it's usually a wandering, you know, Jesus out in the wilderness type thing. So, yeah.
So Noah and these eight people, they're the first who have come back to this several times in the Bible of someone being put in a location and not actually certain what's on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, so there's uncertainty in a lot of, and the fact that Noah's obedient without knowing the end results, right? It's kind of it's instructive, I think, to us, because a lot of times we've all said it. We want to know the end results before we embark on a journey, right? We want to know that we're going to be able to arrive. Noah's on this ark. He has no idea. Someone just said, in a travel, you can see the changing landscape, nothing, right? And he's out here for 150
days.
He's
100% dependent upon God to do whatever, because he's just there.
Yeah.
He can't paddle some direction. I mean,
geez, you know, God sealed up the boat. He didn't.
Yeah.
Open up the door.
Yeah. God tells him to come in. God seals the boat. God is protecting him, but he has no idea. And again, so we just read one verse. It says, but God remembered Noah. Noah may have felt like he had been forgotten. I'm not sure about that. But whenever we use the word remember in reference to God, then God remembered XYZ, it's usually foreshadowing the initiation of a miraculous event. God remembered is really, you know, when the Bible uses that terminology, what it's really trying to say is that this is a turning point, that something big is about to happen. And it's usually in relationship to a promise or to a covenant that God has made. And so God remembers is he made a covenant, he made a promise, and now he's going to fulfill part of that promise. The promise that he made to Noah was that he was going to protect him, that he was going to save him, that he was going to keep him safe. And so when the Bible says that God remembers someone or his covenant with someone, it indicates that he's about to take action for that person's welfare. You see that? So the very next thing says that God made a wind to blow over the earth and the waters subsided. So God caused, and the Hebrew word there for wind is his spirit, R-U-A-C-H, Ruach, not sure how to pronounce that, but it's spirit or wind to pass over the earth. And immediately it says the waters began to subside. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, it said that the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the earth, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. That term of the Spirit of God hovering over the face of the waters in creation is the same term, or it's really echoing the Spirit that's blowing over the waters here. So this is not just a natural event, but it's a miraculous event that's happening, that God is initiating this wind to blow over the earth, and the waters are going to subside here. The other similar action that God takes is from a story that we know of. This is Moses and the Israelites crossing the Red Sea. When God parts the Red Sea, he causes that wind to go across the Red Sea and part the Red Sea. So it's a very similar action here that we see. So it says that the water receded. Look at verse 2. The fountains of the deep and the windows of the heaven were closed, and the rain from the heavens was restrained, and the waters receded from earth continually. At the end of 150 days, the water had abated. So this is a second 150-day period. The waters prevailed on the earth for 150 days in chapter 7, at the end of chapter 7. And then in chapter 8, the waters are receding for 150 days. And we're going to see that water is abating or receding. And so the receding waters is similar. Again, I've already mentioned in the Red Sea, when God parts the Red Seas and the waters recede there in Exodus chapter 14. And then also he does that. Do people remember him doing that again? The Red Sea parts the Red Sea. Anything in the Old Testament similar to that story? Say that.
Crossing the Jordan
River in Joshua chapter 4, verse 18. The same kind of scenario where he's parting those seas. and the water's receding or pulling back. Are you looking that up?
Yeah.
Joshua chapter 4, verse 18. Ken's almost there, so we'll let Ken read it for us.
It's a good idea since this is a hard one.
Silence. When the priests carrying the Ark of the Lord's Covenant came up from the middle of the Jordan and their feet stepped out on solid ground, the waters of the Jordan resumed their course, flowing over all the banks as before.
Oh, it sounds like you need to back up from there.
That was verse 18. Here it is.
Verse.
In the future, when your children ask you, what do you, I'm back in chapter 4, verse 6. So this will be a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, what do these stones mean to you? And you tell them the waters of the Jordan are cut off in front of the Ark of the Lord's Covenant.
So what Bible are you reading?
So,
this is...
We don't have the exact reference, but God did part the Jordan River for the Israelites to cross.
The Jordan's waters were
from the Ark.
No, it's a Google for
part the Jordan waters from the Ark.
He did. And someone will Google that. We'll come back to that. We'll get a good reference. But it did happen, right? Okay. All right.
It happened. Well,
we know it happened. Probably or so. Probably right there, chapter 4 somewhere.
Verse 1.
Let me pick up. Let me go back to Genesis chapter 8. We'll come back to the Jordan River. Genesis chapter 8, verse 4 says, "And in the seventh month of the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. And the waters continued to abate until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen."
Joshua 3,
8. So Ararat is a mountain where? In modern Turkey and Armenia. And it says that the ark came to rest. It's reminiscent of Noah's name. What does Noah's name mean? Does anybody remember? It just said the word.
Rest.
Rest, yeah, Noah's name means rest.
Is Ararat a place? Is it a real place?
Yes.
See, I thought that was in Afghanistan.
My notes say that Mount Ararat is in modern-day Turkey. In fact,
Turkey.
The
yeah,
ESV Turkey. Study Bible says in modern-day Turkey. But it also extends into, it's a mountain range, 15. Not necessarily. So,
it's Joshua 3:15.
Oh, did you find it? Go ahead and read it.
Now the Jordan overflows its banks throughout the harvest season, but as soon as the priests carrying the ark reached the Jordan, their feet touched the water at its edge, and the water flowing downstream stood still, rising up in a mass that extended as far as Adam, a city next to Zarethan. The water flowing downstream into the Sea of the Araba, the Dead Sea, was completely cut off, and the people crossed opposite Jericho. The priests carrying the Ark of the Lord's Covenant stood firmly on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan, while all Israel crossed on dry ground until the entire nation had finished crossing the Jordan.
Cool. So it happened.
Yeah.
We were
15.
Starting 3:15.
3:15.
Commanded to go to the Jordan.
Everybody remembers the Red Sea parting. People don't talk about the Jordan River parted. Probably because there was no movie made about that one.
Well, also, right? It was genocide.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to go.
Okay?
Let's keep it in Genesis chapter 8.
Tragedies, okay?
So, back to Genesis chapter 8. It comes on the mountains of Ararat. Ararat is actually a mountain range. And so it doesn't say the specific mountain. That it's on. There's been lots of speculation. We talked about it here. I remember growing up and watching In Search of
Leonard Nimoy
talking about In Search of the Ark. And
Eric Mandonica, Chariots of the Gods.
And there are and there are lots of different people who have claimed to have actually seen it in the 1800s. Some nomad and his son go up, and his son recounts the whole story of being able to see the Ark and even climbing aboard the Ark. In the mid-80s, And I have, on my other page, I have names of all these people, but an expedition flew over the mountain, and they claimed to have seen the ark and outlined it. And one of the things that I was watching the Discovery Channel the other day, and they were looking for a sunken ship. Actually, it was on 60 Minutes.
On 60
Did y'all
minutes,
see that? Yeah. One of the things that they said is when they see that it was a cargo ship that sunk in the Bermuda. One of the things when they're looking on the radar is that when they see right angles, they're like, that's not natural.
Right.
And so it's the same type of thing when people are looking for the ark on the mountain, when they see these perfect shapes. The point of the whole thing is whether people find the ark or not is irrelevant. I couldn't imagine that Gopher Wood would last that long. And be there forever. So the search for the remnants of the ark, well chronicled, well debated. I think we even, a long, long time ago, and someone may remember this, we even had a guy come to First Baptist Church who was an ark hunter.
Wow.
Yeah. And he talked about, he devoted his life to finding the ark. So, and it was interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting, all the archaeological
stuff.
What was
his theory that it's
do you remember? Do you guys remember?
Sediment somewhere? I mean, no, it still exists.
It's a, buried in the ice. Buried in ice, yeah.
On top of the mountain?
Mm-hmm. So, but the truth of the account doesn't hinge on the discovery of the ark. Like, if we can't find the ark, this must not have happened.
Thomas Cave.
Look at verse... what's that?
James Earl.
James Earl.
James Earl Jones, what?
He actually claimed to have seen. Didn't he claim to have seen it? Yeah,
James
he claimed
Jones?
To have seen it.
No.
James Irwin.
The Stingray guy?
No, Steven.
Steven.
That's a different guy.
Look at, your point, Mark, is that even if we don't find it...
My point is, even if we don't find it, it doesn't... The truth of the account doesn't hinge on the discovery of the ark. And last week we were talking about whether this was a local flood or worldwide flood. When we look at the geological evidence, there are things that indicate that it probably was a worldwide flood of another
historical
and historical. Yeah, worldwide and historical, right? And so there are things in the geological structure, evidence such as, from my notes, evidence such as the worldwide deposits of sedimentary rock. We talked about the dinosaurs before. We talked about ice ages, the formation of mountains, fossils deposited in waterborne sediments, and an unending list of others indicate the worldwide catastrophic changes that the earth experienced. All of those would be expected to be left after a flood of this magnitude, especially sedimentary rock and fossils. Fossils don't happen over long periods of time in terms of this. When we see completely intact animal structures or plant structures, those happened after catastrophic type events.
Vesuvius.
Exactly. And that's the good example is Pompeii, right? And we see intact, I guess, right? And the reason is because they're preserved because of a catastrophic event. And so when we look at the fossil record, many of those fossils are preserved because of a catastrophic event. And those happen, and we see those things worldwide.
Yeah, because otherwise, if you just sort of die on the surface and the flood comes along,
you decay.
You get rain over 30. Yeah, you
decay.
Before your fossils.
And it's the sedimentary rock that comes in and creates the fossils. And so those are indications that there are and have been catastrophic events that were able to cause that. The flood would be a great example of that. We also talked about the fact that the world could have been one continent at the time of the flood, and the flood definitely had to be of an extent that every living creature was dead at the time, perished at the time, right? questions? Pick up in verse 6. Verse 6. At the end of 40 days,
there's that number.
There's another number. Getting all these different numbers here. Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made and sent forth a raven.
Sam Houston.
It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. So does the raven come back?
Probably not.
It doesn't.
It kept flying back and forth.
It says that the raven went to and fro. It doesn't necessarily say that it came back until the waters were dried up from the earth. And so here's the thing, and Jewish rabbis have suggested that Noah first sent out a raven because the raven was one of the unclean animals that he had on the boat, on the ark. A ritually unclean bird was expendable. It wasn't one that he was going to use for a purpose later on. And the fact that it went back and forth from the ark means, this is from the Holman Christian Study Bible if you have that, the fact that it went back and forth from the ark means that it could find no suitable habitat. However, remember, a raven is a carrion. It's an unclean bird. Didn't necessarily return. And one of the...
But it did return.
It went to and fro.
Yeah, well, it came back. It said it flying back.
Back and forth. But
it didn't necessarily back and forth to the ark.
Right.
Back and forth to what?
Back and forth. Across the... That way, then that
across
way,
the face of the waters. So let me give you an interpretation of what may have happened, right? So after the flood, everything is dead. What do carrion birds eat? They eat dead things,
right?
So one of the implications is that this raven went out and it found, for a bird like that, it may have found dead things, right? It may have found food. It may have found different things. And so might be a little bit of a stretch here, but when we talk about the symbolism of this, and I'm not saying that this didn't happen, you know, the raven went out, right? But there can be some symbolism that we see in that. The raven goes out into a dead world, and what does it find?
Nothing.
It does find something.
Death.
It finds death. It goes out into a dead world, it finds death. The raven doesn't, the unclean animal... doesn't necessarily come back. In 1 John 2:15, and I know this is a little bit of a stretch here. Do not love the world
340 days,
or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not with him. The water could have preserved some of the things. Interesting. It's one of the theories. Instead of waiting on the peace that God brings, this is from John MacArthur. Instead of waiting on the peace that God brings, the carrion feasts on the pleasures that it finds. It doesn't come back. And so, remember, hang on. I don't necessarily think that's a stretch, and it's not my stretch anyway. The Jewish rabbis that have read this story talk about the unclean going out.
The Jewish rabbis don't even know
Jesus. And then the dove comes back. Let's look at the dove. Let's look at verse... verse 7, he sent out the raven, it went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. So it's continuing to just fly around until the waters are dried up. Then verse 8, then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters have subsided from the face of the ground. Remember, the dove now is a clean animal. It's much more selective. MacArthur says this, it's much more selective in its choices. The clean animal doesn't go out and find as a carrion would. But the dove found no place to set her foot, in verse 9, and she returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and brought her back into the ark with him. The difference with the raven is you don't see the raven coming back into the ark, right? Maybe it came and perched on top, you know, have no idea.
Well, there was stuff floating. I didn't think about stuff floating around.
And the imagery...
It could have just parked on a piece of wood.
Exactly. And the imagery is that the dove comes back into the safety of the ark. Mm-hmm. And so, again, MacArthur says, not me, that a dove's much more selective in its choices. It's not going to go out. We've all seen the carrion bird on the side of the road eating unthinkable things. So based on this account, let's look at the next thing. So nothing happens there.
Unless you're in Tennessee.
He waited another 7 days, verse 10. And again he sent forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, in his mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. Then he waited another 7 days and sent forth the dove, and she did not return to him any more. So based on this account...
So the raven got her.
Based on this account, a dove with an olive branch has become the universal symbol of peace. Right? The dove with an olive branch. What else does that say? If the dove has an olive branch, that means a tree had time to get planted, had time to grow, had time to, you know, so it's interesting that Noah is perched on the side of this, come to rest on the side of this mountain, but there's still water all around. The water is likely subsiding at different rates in different areas depending on where it has to go. And there is a location where this dove is able to find a growing olive tree and brings back an olive branch. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. And so it's able to bring back an olive branch. And, of course, the symbol there is peace. And now Noah knows. What else does that tell Noah? What are some other things that this tells Noah?
That it's all going to be over. That God's done what he needs to do.
Yeah, that it's over. God's done what he needs to do. What else?
That there's going to be olives.
That there's going to be olives. Okay. The new world, because there's going to be a new world. The new world's going to have olives. Okay. That's good. That's a practical thing. What else?
That God remembered.
That God remembered him. That there would be new life. Right?
That's what I meant.
This God remembered him. There's going to be new life, right? Things are going to grow again.
Yeah.
I mean, all these, to me,
what
if you're Noah...
Ask? What should we ask?
No. To me, no, I'm just searching for what you might think. That no, to me, if you're Noah, you've got lots of questions because you don't know what's going to happen next. Right. I mean, we've already read the story, so we know what's happening, right? But for Noah on the ark, wow. Sends the raven out. Raven doesn't come back. Sends the dove out. The dove comes back. Doesn't find anything. Sends him out again. He finds something. And for Noah, when he sees that olive branch, remember, it has become the universal symbol of peace. Is there now peace with Noah? The wrath of God has ended. Life is returning, right? There's hope probably also returning for Noah. Hope that he's going to get off the ark, right? Probably didn't want to be on the ark, you know, the rest of his life. And so there are a lot of things that are likely going on for Noah. This is a great story, but what does any of this mean to us? What are some of the takeaways that we could have from it?
God, you go through times like this. You went down the path that God told you to go.
Uh-huh.
And it might take years before you ever see the first sight of anything that looks like, oh.
Hope.
That's where we're going? Really?
Yeah. Yeah, man, great. We've been praying for people to get jobs, for example, and a lot of us have been in a position before where work and how are we going to care for our families and people that we know and sons and daughters. Yeah. How are we going to care for our families? How are we going to take care of things? We have lots of questions in our lives. I mean, God has given promises that I think he obviously Noah is a very specific promise. When we get to Abraham, very specific promises, right? But there are other promises that we see even in the New Testament where he promises to care for us, to give us hope. And for Noah, he finds peace. And one of the things that I take away is the perseverance that Noah has, right? The obedience, the faithfulness that he has. To go through this. You don't see Noah complaining. There could have been, you know, Noah got fed up, you know, he got tired. I'm not saying it didn't happen. You know, it could have happened. Very well could have happened. But you don't see evidence necessarily of that happening. And what you do see is that there's obedience. Noah also has, I think it's pretty wise of him, and he's probably a wise fella, to send out the birds, right? What else is he going to do? Let's send out the birds, see what they find. Right? Any other thoughts about what he finds or what he finds out? Pick up in verse 13. In the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried from the earth, and Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the second month of the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. And then God said to Noah, so this is the first time that we see God speaking again to Noah. Yeah. Noah goes into the ark. God tells him, come into the ark. We don't see him speaking again until this time. Go out from the ark. So now he says, go out from the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you, bringing out with you every living thing that is with you of all the flesh, birds and animals, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. This is the command that he gave Adam and Eve. This is the same command that he gave them. Let these animals be fruitful and multiply on the earth. And so Noah went out and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with them. And every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird and everything that moves on the earth went out by families from the ark. One of the reasons, or the biggest reason for him to have all these animals in the ark, was to be able to preserve them and to be able to have them be fruitful and multiply on the face of the earth. So just as God had sealed them in the ark in chapter 7, verse 16, he now invites them to depart the ark. Their security was not in a ship. Their security was in God. He seals them in, and now he opens the door to let them out. Weiserby says this, that obeying the will of God involves not only doing the right thing in the right way for the right motive, but it also means doing it at the right time. Obeying the will of God not only means doing the right thing in the right way for the right motive, but it also means doing it in the right time. And Psalm 31:15 says, my times are in your hands. And that would have to be almost the prayer of Noah. My times are in your hands. I'm committed to you. I'm dependent on you for my safety, for my survival. The Holman Christian Study Bible says, perhaps this is the first time that God had spoken to Noah since before the flood. During the entire year of the catastrophic flood, there's no record that God communicated directly with the patriarch or his family. What faith Noah demonstrated during the terrifying time in the ark's dark interior. And so he says, bring out all the living creatures that are with you, the birds, the livestock, and have them be fruitful and multiply. So every living thing on the earth is a descendant from these ark dwellers. And of course, the demand to be fruitful and multiply reprises the command in Genesis chapter 1, verse 22, be fruitful and multiply. Look at verse 20. Verse 20 says, then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings to the altar. He didn't kill off the two. No. Remember, he had more than just two on the ark.
Killed the other five off.
And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man. Look at the second part of this. No. I will never again curse the ground because of man. For the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. That's mercy and grace. Even after the flood, even after all this, every intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. So he's given a new promise. First of all, Noah, in his obedience, erects an altar. In an obedience to God, he erects this altar, and he. This is basically Noah's first act that's recorded as he comes out of the ark is an act of worship. You see that? So he was obedient and faithful, and then his first act is an act of worship, building an altar to the Lord. He presents whole burnt offerings using some of the clean animals in an expression of gratitude and divine grace. one of the study notes from the ESV study Bible says that the burnt offering soothes God's angers to human sin. So although human nature has not been changed by the flood, God's attitude has changed. God's attitude has changed. And he says, it says here that the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma.
God's a country boy.
There's a loot. Well, oh, the barbecue? Is that what you're thinking? Is it barbecue? And I don't think it's that. You know, I know where you're going with that. And I think the Bible alludes to the fact that the praises of the people and the prayers of the people are presented to him like sweet-smelling incense and a sweet aroma. And so when people are worshiping and people are sincere in their worship and in their prayers, God accepts that. And to God, it's like a sweet-smelling aroma rising up to him. And so that's similar to what's happening here. The Holman Christian Study Bible again says, using anthropomorphic language, words that describe God's actions in human terms, the text notes that the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, and the phrase means that God accepted Noah's sacrifice. Elsewhere in the Torah, such as in Leviticus chapter 26, God refuses to smell the sacrifice, and that means he's rejecting sacrifices. And so there are other times where he refuses to smell that. And so acceptable offerings in other parts of the Bible are said to have a pleasing aroma to God. And so following Noah's sacrifice, the Lord makes a solemn promise never again to curse the ground, as he had done following Adam's sin. And then that last thing I think is very telling. It's almost like with a sense of resignation, God says, although man's inclination is evil from its youth. It's God kind of comes to a conclusion, not that he had to learn this, right? But he comes to the conclusion, this is the state of man. In their fallen state, in their hearts, they're evil from youth. And so in spite of humanity's sinful nature, God's grace and his love is going to prevail. He never again destroy the world as he did in Noah's time. And then there's another promise that's an assurance as well. He says, as long as the earth endures seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, and day and night will not cease. If you think about that, that's a promise of security. It's you're going to be able to live. You're going to make it. There's going to be night and day. There's going to be seed time and harvest. There's going to be cold and heat. There's going to be summer and winter. There's going to be day and night. All these things are going to happen. And in that society where they were dependent on seed time and harvest, that would be a great promise. You're going to sow seeds and you're going to reap the harvest. Do you see that? There's going to be life. I mean, that's an amazing promise. For Noah. I'm going to go ahead and stop it there. End of chapter 8.
Another
whole entire chapter in the books.
Wow. This is dizzying.
I see a lot of parallel between the end of 8 and 1 or 2. Fall. So here's a question. Man is sinful, but there actually is no law at this point. The only law in Eden was don't eat fruit, and that law was broken. In between Adam and Eve being rejected from the garden and Noah's sacrifice, you know, there were a lot of discussions about sin. Cain killed Abel. We had this discussion about fornication and all this sort of thing. But
the law hadn't been written.
There's actually no law written down.
Yeah.
Maybe I should have raised that question 4 weeks ago, but it just occurred to me now, you know, with this sort of acknowledgement that man is sinful, but, you know, we're out of the garden, so there's no law. So what, you know, what's the basis for that? Sacrifice, you know, this sort of, you know, trilogy, if you will, of sin, sacrifice, forgiveness. You know,
but it,
you
know, so kind of I got an answer.
Abrahamic sacrifice
go ahead.
Here.
But the only, I guess, sin per se is obedience or lack of obedience, right? In every one of these examples, only thing that people didn't do was listen to God. So I don't know if that's, I mean.
I think there's definitely, you know, murder, and you could say that.
Right.
Everything is a lack of obedience, right?
Right.
Murder.
Right.
There's, I believe, sexual sin in there somewhere. There's being unequally yoked, whether it's with demons or people. We'll talk about that later again, probably.
Again?
You know, there are sin. There is the ungodly line of Cain and what have you. But Romans addresses what you asked. In Romans chapter 1, verse 19, it says this, "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. For although they know God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanging the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator who's blessed forever." I think that the people pre-Noah were very, very much more in tune to the reality and the fact that God was who he said he was and that he existed. And so anything that they do, and I think that they were still equipped with a conscience, they were still equipped with the knowledge, just as I think we all are from birth, the knowledge of good and evil, right? Remember, and my wife and I have been having this discussion with my son Aaron, when what happened when Adam partook of the knowledge, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? They understood good and evil clearly. I think evil, in some way, their eyes were open to the possibilities of evil. I think that one of the things that happened to them when they partook of that is, and we already talked about a lot of that, about fear and you know, the insecurity, what have you. But I think the other thing that happened to them that gets played out, and it continues to play out until Noah, is that their eyes are open to the possibility of sin. When you're extremely close to the light blocks out the darkness. So when they're close and they're walking with God, talking with God, that light illuminates the darkness because it illuminates everything. And what happens when their first disobedience, it opens them up to the possibilities that there's this world of opportunities for them to be able to go out and do. And a lot of those opportunities, or many of those, or most of those, are sinful. And they become sinful in their heart because they have all these different desires. And man, from that time, even through Noah and beyond, they know the difference between good and evil. And in Romans it says that his invisible attributes have been known to them since creation. And I think they were very in touch with that. And I think even though there wasn't a law, and I think you raise a good point, because the law, when the law is made, it's made to clearly show man their sin and clearly present to them their disobedience. Prior to Noah, although the law wasn't there, it was dependent on their conscience. It was dependent on what they did know. They already knew that God existed. I don't think there was as much doubt about God existing prior to Noah. I think they were openly rebellious, openly disobedient. That's my opinion.
Well, see, here, at the risk of wading into history, you know, my sense could be wrong, is that on the eve of Christ's birth, you segmented humanity into two buckets. There were Jews and there were
Gentiles. Gentiles.
Yeah, so, and so, you know, you roll that back, I mean, the existence of the Jewish nation was essential for Christ, right? So,
right.
Somewhere between Noah and Moses, you know, the Jewish people, as they're going to come to be known, emerge and separate from
society,
from everyone else, and the law is a big part of that. So I don't know, you know, that's kind of what I'm reading this, and uh-huh. A lot of curiosity is what are the sort of the stones on that journey? Because we have the first sacrifice, which, you know, I think foreshadows the Abrahamic sacrifice, but, you know, there's a lot that, I mean, the law's not even in Genesis or even Exodus, it comes later. So
Yeah, you know, Abraham.
We're just peeling this onion.
It's Abraham and the promise to Abraham and Abraham's faithfulness.
There was an intentional obedience to pursue a relationship with the Creator. So,
I think it's largely God initiated, though. Yeah, I don't think it's.
But, yeah, but it's also a desire on our part. It was a desire. God initiated it, I get it. But at the same time, he was obedient. Where did Noah learn to
be obedient?
Build an ark, an altar
from God.
From obedience from God, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I think God pursues us, and we, in obedience, want to pursue Him back. I think going back to your example of the knowledge of good and evil, it's like Pastor Greg when he tells that story about when he was left in the backyard. Remember that classic story?
I remember.
His mom says they were left in the backyard, and his mom leaves, and she says, "Stay in the backyard. Don't leave." All of a sudden, he'd never thought about leaving the backyard, but the backyard seemed really small at that point, and the world on the outside was really big. So I don't know if it's the acknowledgement, the opportunities out there. That was a good opportunity for him, but he had to be obedient, stay in the backyard. So anyway,
to get to your answer, I think we have to trace. It begins with Abraham. It begins with the fact that God sees Abraham and selects and chooses Abraham. And it even goes back further to Shem, which, you know, Noah's sons, we'll read it soon, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And from Shem, you get the Semitic people. And the Semitic people, you get Abraham. Abraham, you get the genealogical line of Christ. And the promises that go along with that. God chose that. And it all goes back to Genesis. And the curse on the serpent, her seed will crush your head. But all of it has been a part of God's plan from the beginning, and he chooses his people to get to the end. The end game for God is Jesus Christ and the redemption of man.
But to me, the post-Noah sinfulness is actually more compelling the garden. Now, here's what I mean by that. You've got Adam and Eve and serpent, they get tricked. But now you'll get eight people survive this ark, and they know all of this.
Yeah.
And yet, the descendants within a few generations, which should be a very compelling oral tradition, they
Tower
lose
Babel.
Touch.
The Tower of Babel. Right. You got the Canaanites, you've got... Yeah. You've got Ham, and is Ham, I think, in the disobedience.
So today we have a clear majority of people on Earth are not of God, right? And but they live off the land. They have gifts of reason and everything, So it's just kind of somewhere along the way, post flood. It's
how did they lose that connection?
Well,
I think he says it right here. I'm not going to destroy the world, even though the heart of man is evil from you.
Yeah, but a lot about what you're talking about is you're forgetting that part.
That we're evil from you.
All evil from you. A lot of what we try to do, a lot of it after Noah, is man trying to define evil, and the way we do that is your stuff is evil, mine's not. Or yours is more evil.
Yeah. If man weren't evil, there would be no missionary work today, right?
There would be no what?
Missionary work today. I mean, it's the existence of sin
missionary
creates
work.
The opportunity for missionary work.
Yeah, I think largely missionary.
If everyone were as faithful and obedient as Noah, what would missionaries do?
Well, missionaries deliver the gospel, so that's the difference.
They deliver the truth.
Just like to chapter 9.
Yeah.
That's my favorite one.
Drunk and naked.
He ends up drunk and naked.
Well, that's about repopulating the earth. Repopulating the earth. By the way, I have an after 7 comment, but I'll reserve it.
You turn that off.
Just don't. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm late.
All right. Good seeing you.
Well, why don't Kim pray for us?